A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that I think lands with a lot of people who'd never describe themselves as anxious. He grew up driving in Ireland, loved it, felt completely at ease. Moved to Israel 10 years ago, got his license here, and now he basically avoids driving unless there's no other option. Not because he can't drive. He's driven the length of the country from Matula to Eilat before, never been in an accident. But something about getting behind the wheel here, especially in Jerusalem, just fries his nerves.
The thing that makes this interesting is the paradox he describes. He says after about 10 minutes in the driver's seat, he feels fine. The fear is worse than the experience. So it's not a skill problem. It's not even a generalized anxiety problem. It's this very specific psychological burden that shows up before and during the first few minutes of driving, then fades once he's actually doing it.
Same driver, same skill set, radically different stress response depending on whether he's on an Irish country road or navigating Jerusalem traffic. And he's asking what you'd say to someone like him, whether there are programs for people whose fear of driving has become a limiting factor. The tension between I can drive and I won't drive is the whole thing.
This is increasingly common. With urbanization accelerating and more people moving between countries and driving cultures, you've got millions of drivers facing a mismatch between their competence and the environment they have to navigate. Someone who learned to drive in rural Sweden and now lives in Mumbai, or someone from suburban Ohio now in Mexico City. The skills transfer, but the psychological adaptation doesn't always follow.
Daniel's case is almost a perfect laboratory example of this. He's not someone with a driving phobia in the clinical sense. He doesn't panic at the thought of getting in a car. He's driven the entire length of Israel. But the specific environment, the aggressive local driving culture, the density of Jerusalem, creates this anticipatory stress that's strong enough to change his behavior.
He names it really precisely. He says it's not that his ability atrophies between drives, it's a psychological burden. He's worried about messing up, missing a crazy driver zigzagging across lanes. That's not irrational. That's someone who's read the environment accurately and is responding to it. The question is why that accurate reading produces a stress response that's disproportionate enough to keep him out of the car.
Let's unpack what's actually happening here. Is this anxiety in the clinical sense, or is it something more specific? And what does the research say about people whose brains are doing exactly what they should be doing in a high-stress driving environment, but the cost to their daily life has gotten too high?
The clinical distinction here is actually really useful. What Daniel's describing is situational driving anxiety, which is different from a specific phobia of driving. A phobia means you're afraid of the act itself, anywhere, under any conditions. Situational anxiety means the fear is triggered by a particular context. In his case, aggressive urban Israeli traffic, and Jerusalem most of all.
It's not, I'm afraid to drive. It's, I'm afraid to drive here.
And the prevalence data backs up how common this is. Research shows about a third of drivers, roughly 33%, report some form of driving anxiety. But only 6 to 10% meet the diagnostic criteria for a specific phobia. That gap is enormous. It means the vast majority of people who feel stressed behind the wheel don't have a disorder. They're having a context-dependent response just like Daniel.
Which reframes the whole question. If a third of drivers feel this way in certain situations, we're not talking about a pathology. We're talking about a normal brain doing its job in an environment that demands hypervigilance.
The Israeli driving context is a fascinating case study for this. Because on paper, the numbers don't suggest Israel is unusually dangerous. The traffic fatality rate here is actually below the OECD average. Despite everything that feels terrifying, the objective risk is lower than what the stress response would predict.
That's the part that's hard to internalize when someone is 6 inches from your bumper and leaning on the horn. How does an aggressive driving culture produce below average fatalities?
Part of it is that what looks like chaos to an outsider is actually a kind of communication system, The honking, the forced merging, the constant negotiation of space, it's not random aggression, it's a cultural dialect. Drivers here are signaling intent constantly, just in a way that reads as hostile if you didn't grow up with it. The system works, but it's high friction.
Daniel's brain is interpreting, "I'm about to be hit," when the local driver is actually saying, "I am asserting my presence. Please adjust accordingly."
That's the cognitive reappraisal piece. And we'll get deeper into that. But the point for now is that his anxiety isn't a miscalibration. It's an accurate reading of signals he hasn't been trained to interpret as anything other than threat. The environment is objectively more demanding of vigilance than Irish country roads. His brain is not broken. It's doing the math correctly and producing a stress response proportional to the perceived demands.
Which means the goal isn't to pathologize this, or tell someone to just relax. The goal is to figure out why the stress response is costing him more than it should, and what to do about it.
To understand why the fear persists, even though nothing bad has ever happened, we need to look at what's going on in the brain during those first 10 minutes behind the wheel. And the key players here are the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex.
The amygdala, being the brain's threat detection system, the part that fires before you've even consciously registered what you're looking at.
And the prefrontal cortex is the rational overseer, the part that can look at a situation and say, "This is fine, we've done this before." In a familiar driving environment like Daniel on Irish country roads, the prefrontal cortex has a well-worn model of what's normal. The amygdala stays quiet because nothing in the scene registers as novel or threatening.
Drop that same driver into Jerusalem traffic.
Now the prefrontal cortex doesn't have a reliable model. The sensory input is radically different. Constant honking, cars merging from unexpected angles, pedestrians stepping into the road, narrow streets with parked vehicles on both sides. The amygdala starts flagging anomalies at a rate the prefrontal cortex can't keep up with, and this is where the hypervigilance loop kicks in. Hypervigilance is when your threat detection system stays in an elevated state of scanning. Normally, you encounter a potential threat, assess it, and either act or dismiss it. But in an environment like aggressive urban traffic, the threats don't stop coming. Every few seconds, there's a new input that could be dangerous. The sympathetic nervous system, your fight-or-flight response, stays activated. Cortisol and adrenaline keep circulating. The prefrontal cortex never gets the breathing room to say, "Okay, we've got this, stand down."
Daniel's first 10 minutes of stress isn't just nerves. It's his brain genuinely working overtime to process an environment it wasn't trained on.
Here's the crucial detail. That 10-minute settling period he describes. That's roughly how long it takes for the prefrontal cortex to build a temporary model of the current driving conditions and start inhibiting the amygdala's threat responses. It's not that the threats disappear. It's that his brain finally assembles enough pattern recognition to say, "I've seen this before. This is just how it works here."
Which explains why the fear comes back fresh next time he gets in the car, after a few weeks.
The temporary model decays. The brain doesn't retain it as a permanent update because he's not reinforcing it frequently enough. So each time he drives, he's essentially rebuilding that model from scratch during the first 10 minutes. The amygdala treats Jerusalem traffic as novel every single time.
This connects to something he mentioned. He said his driving ability doesn't atrophy between trips, but the psychological burden is always there waiting. That distinction is actually backed by research.
Studies on skill decay show that procedural driving skills, the physical act of steering, braking, shifting, scanning mirrors, those remain remarkably stable even after months without practice. Your body remembers. But psychological self-efficacy, your belief that you can handle a specific situation, degrades much faster. Daniel's fine after 10 minutes because the procedural skills never left. What eroded was his confidence that those skills are sufficient for Jerusalem traffic.
The gap between drives is long enough for self-efficacy to decay, but not long enough for actual driving skill to degrade. He's stuck in this window where his body knows what to do, but his brain doesn't trust it.
Jerusalem makes this worse in ways that are measurable. The urban density numbers tell part of the story. Jerusalem has about 4,200 vehicles per square kilometer. Tel Aviv, by comparison, has about 3,100. That's a 35% difference in vehicle concentration.
In a city with narrower streets and less parking infrastructure.
And it's not just density. Jerusalem has a unique mix of driving populations. You've got secular drivers, ultra-Orthodox drivers who may have different norms around traffic patterns, Palestinian drivers from East Jerusalem, tourists and pilgrims who have no idea where they're going, all navigating the same compressed space. The driving culture isn't uniform. It's multiple cultures colliding at low speed in tight quarters.
Low speed being the operative word. Most of the stress isn't happening at highway speeds, where the stakes feel existential. It's at 30 kilometers an hour, while someone tries to parallel park into a space that doesn't exist.
Which brings us to the near-miss memory phenomenon. Daniel mentioned his fears about messing up, missing a crazy driver zigzagging across lanes. He's never been in an accident, but the fear is still there. That's because the brain doesn't weigh all driving experiences equally. It has a negativity bias and threat learning.
One close call outweighs 100 uneventful trips.
It makes evolutionary sense. If you're an early human and you survive a near miss with a predator, your brain needs to encode that experience so deeply that you never forget the warning signs. The cost of forgetting a real threat is death. The cost of remembering a threat that never materialized again is just some wasted vigilance. Evolution bets on vigilance.
Daniel's brain is doing exactly what it evolved to do. It's holding on to every near miss, every aggressive merge, every sudden break, and using those memories to prime the threat detection system before he even turns the key.
There's a useful parallel here with research on combat veterans. Studies have found that veterans who drive calmly in normal civilian traffic can experience sudden hyperarousal when they encounter visual triggers that resemble combat environments. Overpasses, debris on the road, vehicles approaching from certain angles. The amygdala doesn't distinguish between a genuine threat and a pattern that merely resembles one. It fires first and asks questions later.
Daniel's version of the overpass trigger is someone tailgating him on a narrow Jerusalem street.
His brain has learned that tailgating equals potential collision. In Ireland, that equation might be accurate. In Israel, tailgating is often just how people signal they'd like you to speed up or move over. But his threat learning system doesn't know the cultural difference. It just sees the pattern and hits the alarm.
The fear persists not because Daniel is broken, but because his brain is applying Irish threat calibration to Israeli driving signals and getting a mismatch every time. The 10-minute settling period is how long it takes to recalibrate.
That recalibration doesn't stick because he's not driving often enough for the brain to treat Jerusalem traffic as the default environment. Each drive is a one-off recalibration event rather than a reinforcement of a permanent update.
If the mechanism is context-dependent hypervigilance that resets between drives, the question becomes what actually breaks that cycle. What can someone like Daniel do, starting tomorrow?
The evidence points to a few things that work. The gold standard is cognitive behavioral therapy with exposure components. Clinical trials show 70 to 80% efficacy for driving anxiety. But here's the part that matters for Daniel specifically. The exposure has to be context-specific. Driving calmly on quiet suburban streets doesn't generalize to Jerusalem traffic. The brain needs to learn safety in the exact environment that triggers the fear.
Which means the therapy has to happen in the chaos, not in a parking lot.
And that's logistically hard. You can't control Jerusalem traffic for a therapy session, which is why virtual reality exposure therapy has become such an interesting tool here. Modern VR driving simulators can recreate aggressive traffic scenarios. Tailgating, sudden merges, people honking and cutting in, all in a controlled setting where the driver knows, at some level, that nothing bad can actually happen.
You're teaching the amygdala that these patterns aren't emergencies, without actually being in danger.
The data is strong. A 2025 meta-analysis, so this is recent, found that VR exposure reduces driving anxiety scores by 40 to 60% after 6 to 8 sessions. That's substantial. You're not eliminating the stress. You're bringing it down from paralyzing to manageable.
6 to 8 sessions is not nothing, but it's also not a years-long commitment.
The other approach that's particularly relevant to Daniel's situation is cognitive reappraisal training. This is the reframing technique, teaching drivers to interpret honking, tailgating, forced merging, not as personal attacks, but as cultural communication. The shift is from, they're attacking me, to, this is how people negotiate space here.
Which connects directly to what we said earlier about Israeli driving being a dialect rather than chaos.
And reappraisal isn't just positive thinking. It's a specific technique with measurable effects on amygdala reactivity. When you consciously narrate aggressive behavior as communication rather than threat, you're giving the prefrontal cortex a framework to process the input before the amygdala can hijack the response.
Instead of, that guy is trying to kill me, it's that guy is informing me he exists and would like to occupy this space.
That sounds almost absurdly simple, but in clinical practice it makes a real difference. The brain needs an alternative interpretation, and it needs to practice that interpretation until it becomes the default.
What about formal programs? Daniel asks specifically if there are programs for people whose fear of driving has become a limiting factor.
They exist, but they're not widely advertised. The Israeli Ministry of Transportation's safe driving courses include anxiety management components. There are private clinics, too. OFR Driving Rehabilitation is one that offers specialized programs for driving anxiety. The catch is availability. These programs are limited, and most people don't know they exist.
It's not that there's nothing. It's that you have to go looking.
For a lot of people, the barrier is that they don't think their problem is serious enough to warrant a program. Daniel might not think of himself as someone who needs driving rehabilitation. He can drive. He's driven the whole country. But if avoidance is shaping his decisions about where he goes and how he lives, that's exactly what these programs are designed for.
There was a 2024 study on Israeli drivers specifically. What did that find?
Participants who completed 8 sessions of CBT with in vivo exposure, meaning actual driving in actual traffic with a therapist, showed a 65% reduction in avoidance behaviors at the 6-month follow-up. That's not just feeling better, that's people actually changing what they do, getting back in the car for trips they'd been avoiding.
In vivo means they're doing it in the exact environment Daniel finds most stressful.
Which is why the results held at 6 months. The learning stuck because it happened in context. Compare this to how driving schools in Japan handle something similar. They use systematic desensitization through graduated traffic complexity. Start in empty lots, move to quiet streets, then moderate traffic, then dense urban environments. Each step only happens after the driver shows physiological calm at the previous level.
That graduated exposure model is something Daniel could actually self-administer.
And that's where the self-help evidence gets practical. Graduated exposure means driving the same stressful route at progressively busier times. Start at 5 in the morning on a Sunday when Jerusalem is quiet. Do that route until it feels boring. Then shift to 6:30. You're systematically teaching the brain that this specific environment is safe at increasing levels of difficulty.
He mentioned that after 10 minutes he feels fine. So the goal is to make those 10 minutes less punishing.
2 techniques with actual evidence here. One is the 4-7-8 breathing pattern. Inhale for 4 seconds, hold for 7, exhale for 8. It directly activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the brake on the fight-or-flight response. Doing that during the first 10 minutes gives the prefrontal cortex more bandwidth to do its job.
4-7-8 while someone is tailgating you. That's a skill in itself.
But it's trainable. The other technique is cognitive preloading. Before you even get in the car, you mentally rehearse the specific aggressive scenarios you're likely to encounter. Someone cutting in, someone honking, someone tailgating. You visualize it, and you practice your reappraisal response. This is communication, not threat. By the time it actually happens, your brain has already run the simulation, and the amygdala doesn't treat it as novel.
You're essentially doing the 10-minute recalibration before you turn the key.
That's exactly what it is. And for someone like Daniel, who drives every few weeks, doing 5 minutes of preloading before each trip could significantly compress that settling period. The brain doesn't have to build the model from scratch because you've already primed it. All of this research points to a few concrete things our listener and anyone in a similar situation can actually do. And the first thing is the reframe itself. Your anxiety is not a personal failing. It's a rational response to an environment that demands constant hypervigilance. The goal isn't to eliminate the anxiety, it's to reduce its cost to your life.
That's the shift. You're not broken. You're accurately reading a high-demand environment. The question is just whether the vigilance is costing you more than it should.
If it is, here's the 3-step plan that falls directly out of the evidence. Step 1, identify your specific triggers. Is it merging? Daniel mentioned the zigzagging driver across lanes. Pinpoint exactly what spikes your stress and build a graduated exposure hierarchy around those triggers, not around driving in general.
Which means if tailgating is the thing, you don't start by practicing highway driving. You start by driving on roads where tailgating is less intense, at times when traffic is light, and you work up.
Step 2. Practice cognitive reappraisal before you even get in the car. Narrate aggressive behavior as cultural communication. Not "this person is endangering me," but "this person is negotiating space" in the local dialect. Do it out loud if it helps. The brain needs to hear the alternative interpretation.
Step 3. Treat those first 10 minutes as active coping time, not as something to white-knuckle through. Deliberate breathing, the 4-7-8 pattern, paired with self-talk that reminds you the stress will naturally decrease. You already know it fades after 10 minutes. Use that knowledge.
Now, when does this cross the line into needing professional help? The threshold is functional. If avoidance is costing you real opportunities, jobs, social connections, medical access, or if you're experiencing actual panic attacks rather than just elevated stress, seek CBT with a driving anxiety specialist. Ask specifically about VR exposure therapy availability.
Daniel, if you're hearing this, the fact that you can drive the length of the country and feel fine after 10 minutes means the problem isn't your skill, and it's not permanent. It's a mismatch between your driving style and the local traffic culture. That mismatch is fixable.
The programs exist, they're just not well advertised. But even without a formal program, the graduated exposure and reappraisal techniques are things you can start tomorrow morning. There's a question I keep coming back to with all of this. We're maybe 5 to 10 years out from autonomous vehicles being common on roads like these. When the car is doing the driving, does situational driving anxiety just evaporate? Or does the hypervigilance transfer to a new target?
That's the thing. If your brain has been trained to scan for threats in Jerusalem traffic, handing the wheel to an AI doesn't automatically retrain it. You're just scanning the AI's decisions instead of your own. Did it see that merge? Why isn't it breaking?
The vigilance might shift from executing to monitoring, and monitoring an autonomous system you don't fully trust could be its own kind of exhausting. You're not gripping the wheel, but you're gripping the armrest, second-guessing every gap the car takes.
The anxiety doesn't become a historical curiosity. It just changes costumes. The same amygdala, same hypervigilance loop, different thing to worry about.
Which makes the skills we've been talking about, reappraisal, breathing, graduated exposure, arguably more relevant, long-term, not less. You're not just learning to drive in Jerusalem. You're learning to manage your brain's threat response in an environment you can't control.
To Daniel's situation specifically, the fact that he could drive calmly on Irish country roads and feel that same calm return after 10 minutes in Jerusalem traffic, that's the proof right there. The problem was never his skill. It was the mismatch between his driving instincts and the local traffic culture. That mismatch is real, it's measurable, and it's fixable.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, Buzkashi matches in the Comoros were scored using a unit called the Noma, equal to the weight of the goat carcass divided by the number of riders still mounted at the end of play, which worked out to roughly 7 kilograms of goat per horseman.
Right? Something to watch as autonomous driving creeps into places like Jerusalem. Whether the stress follows the driver into the passenger seat, or whether letting go of the wheel finally lets the brain stand down. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.